History Show with Maz Duncan.
Good evening and welcome to the History Show on RTE Radio 1. On this week's programme, Grace O'Malley, feminist icon, the life of the political and maritime leader, and why she was airbrushed from the history books for so long. Also, Thomas More reimagined, ahead of the concert at the Abbey Theatre this Friday, celebrating the great Irish bard, we look back at his life and legacy. Plus, 100 years of women in Irish politics and public life, the exhibition that shines a spotlight on how women have contributed over the last century and explores the challenges and obstacles they overcame. It's 51551 for your texts and at RTE History Show on Twitter. And we begin this evening with Grace O'Malley. For my next guest, the life of the 16th century pirate, matriarch and political leader shines as an inspirational role model for women of the 21st century. I'm joined by Anne Chambers, author of the book Grace O'Malley, the biography of Ireland's pirate queen, 1530 to 1603, a book that has recently been reissued in a special 40th anniversary edition. Anne, you're very, very welcome.
Thank you, Miles.
Take us back to where you discovered Grace O'Malley, because I think it would be pretty familiar, I think, to people nowadays, but that's actually in many ways largely through your work. So how did you discover her? Because she wouldn't necessarily have been somebody who would have appeared in school books, in history books, when you got started on this.
Absolutely, Miles, and that's really what motivated me. I'm from the west of Ireland, and we used to go as children to the seaside for our annual holidays to around the Clube area most associated with her. And there I heard the folk tales, and every pile of rubble was said to be, you know, Grace O'Malley's Gráinne Wales Castle. And yet when I went to school, I never, like you said, read about her in history. Now, I know lots of women have been airbrushed out of history, but we don't have that many women leaders in Irish history, and she certainly never really appeared. And then motor on, like most people from the west of Ireland, I came to Dublin and I started working in the central bank when Ken Whittaker was governor there. And he knew of my interest in Grace O'Malley. And in my early 20s, I had said to him, you know, that someday I might try and find out, did this woman really exist?
Because, and if she did. I was going to ask you, did you actually think that she was a myth or a legend and that she didn't actually exist as an historical character?
Absolutely, because you're thinking of Queen Maeve of Connacht, another powerful woman, but she belongs in the legendary Ireland. And one thought of Grace O'Malley in the same way. But I got going in my early 20s and I did the first edition of the book. And I suppose in a way it was too good a subject to start off with, because really and truly what I found was a woman that was vastly more experienced than I was in my early 20s. You know, we often think of her as the pirate, but we also have to think of her, of course, as a great political tactician. We have to think of her as a great businesswoman, a political tactician, a survivor in an age that was very, very difficult in Irish history, as well as being a wife, a mother, a divorcee, a lover, a grandmother, a great-grandmother.
I was astonished to read that she does not feature in the annals of the Four Masters, which were written only a couple of decades after her death.
Yes, and about 40 miles up the coast, you know, in Sligo. And the greatest insult to her, I suppose, was that, you know, she appeared as a footnote to her husband's castle and to a husband, which I'm sure she would have frowned on. When you hear of what Sir Henry Sidney said when he met her in 1577 in Galway, that, you know, she brought with her her husband, for she was as well by land as by sea, well more than Mrs. Mate with him. So that's really the Shakespearean way, as they wrote at the time, saying who wore the trousers in that particular marriage.
Okay, you didn't find anything about her in the four annals of the Four Masters, but there was, you did discover historical records and you did discover documentation and you just discover that she was a real human being.
Absolutely. Without the English state papers, really, Grace O'Malley wouldn't have featured in any history. Thankfully, the Elizabethan state papers of the period, which I researched all these years ago and did a bit more indeed for this edition, they were held in the Public Record Office. They were in the Lambeth Palace Library and various places around England. And then I got access to a private collection of manuscripts in Westport House, courtesy of Grace O'Malley's 13th great-grandson in descent, the late Lord Altamont. And between all of that, this fantastic story that really really had been kept alive. And we have to say, really, that folklore also played its part in keeping the memory of Grace O'Malley alive. You have to have made a huge impact on your life to have been kept alive by folklore, by the retelling of stories from fireside to fireside for 400 years.
Yeah, she's pretty colourful, though, when it comes to folklore. Yes. So you would imagine that any folklorist would seize on Grace O'Malley, and we've got to keep telling these stories. Interestingly, she may have been written out of history, but she wasn't written out of geography. It's a very interesting map dating from 1599, 1600 or thereabouts. Tell us about the map of Battista Boazio.
Battista Boazio was a map maker of Italian extraction, and he, shortly after Grace O'Malley met with Queen Elizabeth in 1593 in London, this map was drawn for Ireland. Now, it's easy to say, you know, draw a map of Ireland, but if you see what the previous maps had been, you wouldn't recognise Ireland. So the Battista Boazio map was perhaps the most accurate map of the time. And there, in among all the political bigwigs of the time, is the name Grace O'Malley. So she made such an impact on her times politically that she was included in this political map of Ireland by Boazio.
Tell us about Ireland at that time, because you're talking about the era of the Tudor conquest of Ireland, and she spans from basically from Henry VIII, although she would have been quite young at that stage, right up to the death of Queen Elizabeth I. But, you know, although there was a conquest going on, large parts of Ireland would have been either autonomous or semi-autonomous at that stage.
Yes, it was. This is one of the reasons I think that Grace O'Malley was written out of history, because she didn't conform to what later generations of historians wanted Irish women to be, either very charitable, God-fearing, or nationalistic symbols. The 16th century did not have any flag of nationalism. It was an era of divided loyalties, the country divided into about 40 different chieftainships, which Grace O'Malley's father was one. And you had this terrible feuding. If you think back to maybe Braveheart, you will think the same in Scotland, the feuding clans, unable to see the bigger picture, and that a more modern and acquisitive neighbour and more powerful neighbour would take advantage of that, divide and conquer. So Grace O'Malley had to operate within this very, very divisive and traumatic period of history, and consequently survival became the spur for everything she did to protect herself, her family, her extended family, and the 200 men that she led by land and by sea.
Okay, by sea is the interesting part, because although we're a seafaring nation, we don't seem to have such an interesting history when it comes to, well, piracy. Let's give it a name. But the O'Malleys were a seafaring clan.
Yes, they were very, very different to the other clans in Ireland, and they were seafaring. There are 2,000 years ago of history, the O'Malleys are always referred to as being seafarers. So if Grace O'Malley had been a man, or a son of her father, we possibly wouldn't be speaking about her much tonight. The fact that she was a woman, the sea really was the last barrier really towards women. Women and the sea did not go hand in hand. It was like oil and water. Superstition abounded about women on board ship, and certainly no woman had ever taken the helm. So this is another mitigating factor against Grace O'Malley, and really contributor to her being written out of history. That a woman could lead by sea was almost unheard of, you know. You'd have, again, to go back to the legendary times. There is no other comparable person, a woman like Grace O'Malley, as a leader by sea.
Educated as well, wasn't she?
Oh, yes.
A linguist.
We often, you know, the fiction and the folklore said that she spoke in Latin with Queen Elizabeth. She did not speak in Latin. There was no need for her to speak in Latin. She both knew and read and could speak English. And that is very, very obvious from the many people in the English administration in Ireland, including then, of course, with Queen Elizabeth I and the great Lord Burghley. She corresponded quite a bit with him. And it is very obvious that she spoke and understood English.
Okay, her married life was interesting, to put it mildly. She married twice. Well, first of all, she married Donal O'Flaherty, and then Richard Burke, Iron Richard Burke, and Donal and Cuggy, Donal of the Battles. Were they political matches or were they love matches?
Well, the first marriage would have been, as the daughter of a chieftain, Grace O'Malley is, of course, we forget as well, Gaelic aristocracy. So therefore, her marriage had to play political dividends for her clan. So she was married off in an arranged match at 15 years of age. She lived with Donal An Cogaí, and you name the name An Cogaí in Irish means of the battles, and he certainly was one of these headless chickens that were of Gaelic chieftains that couldn't see the bigger picture. And he particularly was very warlike. You know, this was the time that only a man could be, only a male could be a Gaelic chieftain. The days of the women chieftains go back to Queen Maeve of Connacht. That was all swept away when Roman law, and with it, women being put in their place, basically. They couldn't become a chieftain. And Grace O'Malley, of course, just thumbed her nose at both her own tradition and the English incoming tradition, and made herself, by example, a chieftain. But she superseded Donal An Cogaí because he was so irresponsible. He brought great trauma onto his clan, and it is she who supersedes him. And of course, he was then killed in one of the many feuds at the time. Her second husband was Richard in Aran Burke, the most powerful man in Connacht at the time, and she chose him. And it was said that after 1 year of marriage, she chose also to divorce him. And we, you know, people say, well, that was the legend and that was the folklore. But of course, the Brehon Law allowed for that. It was the right of either man or woman to be divorced if they so wished. But from my research, I see that they kept together, they came together again. They had one son, Tibbog na Long, Toby of the Ships, who was born aboard Grace O'Malley's ship, indeed. And he inherited his mother's great seafaring tradition and went on to become really a very, very successful man. And indeed, it was one of the chieftains in Gaelic Ireland who didn't lose his lands after Kinsale, thanks to what his mother did for him with Queen Elizabeth I.
Why was she known then as a pirate queen?
Well, piracy and plunder is part and parcel of seafaring life, no matter whether you go to the South China Seas, Cornwall, or the west coast of Ireland. It is part and parcel, but the piracy thing as well was more romantic, you know, and it was more dynamic, and it kept this whole idea of the great pirate queen alive. Of course, she went on plundering raids, and indeed, on one of such plundering raids, I found she was captured by the great Earl of Desmond, who was under suspicion by Elizabeth at the time of being in contact with her great enemy, Philip II of Spain. And Desmond handed Grace O'Malley over to the English to keep the English from his own front door. And she was incarcerated in Dublin Castle for a year. Now, only the most powerful political prisoners were taken, as you know, to Dublin Castle. And she was there for a full year. We'll never know how she got out, but she did. I think her husband went into rebellion in Mayo, and she said to Sir John Perrott, who was the Lord Deputy at the time, listen, I can bring him to heel if you let me out. And that's, I think, what happened.
The piracy at the time, I suppose you could say, was a form of taxation almost.
Yes, it was. And, you know, I found some documentation to show that Grace O'Malley's own father, for example, issued licenses to Spanish, French and English fishermen to fish his rich sea domains. And you see, Galway City was the great emporium for trade on the west coast. But the merchant princes of Galway City had taxes which really prohibited the Gaelic chieftains from trading there, well, in a beneficial way, let's say. So the O'Malleys in turn said, well, if your ships have to travel our sea territory, then we'll take tolls on them. And Grace O'Malley was a great exponent of that and became a very wealthy woman indeed on her toll-taking enterprise.
Talk to me about the relationship that she had with the English governor, the Queen's representative in Connacht, the man called Richard Bingham.
Well, she got on very well with the previous ones, Lord Deputy Sidney, the famous Sir Henry Sidney, who was the father, of course, of the very famous Sir Philip Sidney, was here on three separate occasions as Lord Deputy, and she got on very, very well with him and managed to do deals with him. But when Sir Richard Bingham came, he came with two additional problems for Grace O'Malley. Firstly, he didn't like her. He didn't like the idea of a woman leader. And secondly, he was part of what even Elizabeth didn't like in her court, of the Puritan side of English politics that was happening at the time. So he was doubly antagonistic to Ireland. And he said the Irish could only be tamed by the sword. So three times Grace O'Malley led rebellions against him in Mayo. He did capture her at once, and she talks herself. She tells Queen Elizabeth he erected a gallows where she thought she would end her days. And she was let at liberty because all the chieftains of Mayo came and gave Bingham hostages to release her. She was so important as an iconic leader for them at that stage. So eventually Bingham killed her eldest son, Owen O'Flaherty, and when he captured Tibbet na Long, her favourite younger son, it was then that she decided to go over his head and appeal to his boss in England, who was Queen Elizabeth I.
And not just by letter, but in person. And this is one of the astonishing things about Grainne Whelan, about Grace O'Malley, that she actually goes to London. I mean, she goes under her own steam, as it were.
Yes, she does. Now, firstly, they meet at they're elderly. They're in their 60s. 60s in the 16th century is like in the 80s today. So we're talking about two experienced women, both in a man's world. Grace O'Malley did not go willy-nilly and bang on the door of Greenwich Palace and say, I'm the Queen of the West and I'm here to see the Queen of England. You wouldn't do that today with Queen Elizabeth II. There was a protocol that had to go through. But such is Grace O'Malley's intuitiveness and her connection with the wider world outside her remoter area. Don't forget, the sea to her was always a highway, never a barrier, a highway to new languages, cultures, to people. And she knew her way around it. And she knew that the Earl of Ormond was related to Queen Elizabeth I. And I found a lovely little letter of introduction by Black Tom, Earl of Ormond, to ask Lord Burghley, Queen Elizabeth's secretary, to see this woman. So she went with a covering letter of introduction by the great Earl of Ormond, who was Queen Elizabeth's cousin and favourite at court. And she hung around the court in July 1593. And I found what Burghley sent her. Before she got to see the Queen, Burghley wrote out 18 questions that he wanted Grace O'Malley to reply to. And her replies are there. So in effect, in the state papers, is almost a potted autobiography of Grace O'Malley herself. And she talks about laws, the Breton law versus English law. She talks about her family. She talks, of course, about Bingham and what the awful things that he had done to her family. And eventually, she meets with Elizabeth.
And secures the release of her children?
Yes, the letter that Elizabeth wrote about the meeting, which I've published now in this new edition of the book, really shows a new Elizabeth. We here always think of her in Irish history as something else. She was a woman in a man's world, and she really did give to Grace O'Malley everything that she wanted. Her son was released from prison, and more than anything else, Grace O'Malley managed to get her, and Elizabeth says it herself, that she can go back to the sea, which Bingham had almost barred her from doing, this time to fight, as Elizabeth wrote, in our quarrel with all the world. But once back on the wild west coast of Ireland, you can imagine the interpretation that was given.
And was this female solidarity, do you think, on the part of Queen Elizabeth?
I think there is, yes, there is. There's a little bit of cattiness there. Both of them were the same age, and I noticed in the letter Elizabeth says to Bingham, have pity and on this poor aged woman. Now, both of them were the same age. So we had a little bit of the female spat there as well.
Are there modern resonances, do you think, with Grace O'Malley's story?
Oh, most certainly.
I mean, there aren't too many pirates. Well, not in this part of the world,
well,
anyway.
Well, you know, we leave the piracy aside. As I said, that was part and parcel of seafaring life everywhere. But Grace O'Malley, really, as a woman, when you see the awful situation politically in which she had to survive to protect her family, she comes over as the great matriarchal figure, not merely of her own family, but to the wider clans in the area. You see her as a very, very successful businesswoman. She accumulated a herd of cattle, which, of course, everything was numbered in cattle during that time. There was very little currency around. And she had she really was a fantastically tuned in woman and clued in woman. The fact that men from different clans, with all their feudal tribing going on, would agree to be led by a woman, by land and by sea in the 16th century shows great courage, great charisma, and above all else, she had to be successful.
Well, the book is Grace O'Malley, the biography of Ireland's pirate queen. It's out now in a lovely 40th anniversary edition published by Gill Books. The author is Anne Chambers. Anne, many thanks for joining us this evening on The History Show. Staying in Mayo, a quick word about an event that's coming up this week in Ballina. On Friday the 1st of February, the Jackie Clark Collection is launching its new exhibition on the War of Independence. Jackie Clark was a native of Ballina whose passion for Irish history, and particularly revolutionary history, has become synonymous with his name. And throughout his life, he collected over 15,000 items spanning 400 years of Irish history. He died in 2000, aged 73, and in 2005, his widow, Mrs. Anne Clark, gifted his collection to Mayo County Council and the people of Ireland. The archive team has been busy unearthing more of Jackie's rare artefacts, letters, photographs, autograph books, which relate to the events of January 1919, right up until the signing of the treaty in December of 1921. And the launch begins at 3 p.m. at the Jackie Clark Collection on Pierce Street in Ballina. All are welcome to attend. And there's also an online catalogue listing Jackie's items available on their website, clarkcollection.ie. We'll put those details on our website. After the break, the music of Thomas Moore.
Follow us on Twitter at RTE History Show.
This Friday, the 1st of February, the band The Moorings will present a night of music at the Abbey Theatre called Thomas Moore Reimagined, which celebrates the great Irish bard. I'm joined by Simon Morgan of The Moorings. Simon, you're very welcome indeed. We're going to hear one of the songs that you're performing often, The Stilly Night, in a moment. But we'll start by talking a little bit about the man himself, who led a very interesting life indeed. The son of a greengrocer, born in 1779 in Ainger Street in Dublin, and went on to study at Trinity College. That in itself was unusual for somebody like him at that time. Why was that?
Well, it had only been opened up the year before. So 1793, up till then, no Catholics had been allowed in. And he joined in 1794. So he was among a band of a very few amount of Catholics, all of whom, of course, were rebellious by their very religion.
He would have been in Trinity College at around the same time as Robert Emmet. Were they acquainted?
Yeah, so Robert Emmet was there the year before him, and he was a big character in the college. So when he came in, he would have met him in history societies, in debating societies, and they became very good friends. And they would have played music together. Indeed, they both enjoyed listening to, or he would play the piano, Thomas Moore, and play Bunting's collection of Irish music, which had just come out, and would inspire Emmet. He would say, God, I'd love to be listening to that tune while leading a, you know, marching with 20,000 men. So it was quite a, they were both big influences on each other.
And this, of course, was the era of the great Belfast Harp Festival, which was in, what, 1796, I think it was, or yeah, was it around about that time anyway?
Yeah, so like Bunting had earlier on in the century had collected quite a number of he'd gone up to the Belfast Harp Festival and collected all the old tunes, which was extremely important, we know now, because a lot of the old harpists were dying, and indeed a lot of O'Carolan's pupils had were just dying. They were in their 90s at the time of the festival, so he did really good work, Bunting did.
Now, how political was Thomas Moore? Because obviously his friend Robert Emmet was exceptionally political, but would have been a member of the United Irishmen, even in Trinity, during his days in Trinity. Was Moore that overtly political?
He was, but he probably wasn't as radical. He would have been like his parents. He would have been more the gentleman, the Grattan and the Flood, and doing it in Parliament as opposed to doing it by the methods that Emmet went with. Although, while in Trinity, he did write a piece in the United Irishmen, the paper, the press, calling his fellow Trinity students. It was an anonymous article, but he later admitted to Emmet that he had been the person behind it. So he was certainly in those years, and as a young man, would have been very political, but not in the same radical way as
Not a revolutionary, not somebody who was going to carry a pike or carry a musket.
I think it can be difficult. You know, he lived a full life, so he has all of life's compromises. But actually, he probably did just as much for Ireland in terms of being able to whisper in the ear while singing his mesmerising songs and his beautiful romantic ballads. He would also have, he had a sharp tongue in some of his lyrics, but they passed, you know, they passed by because he was such an amazing presence himself. So I think he did a lot.
Talk to me then about his connection with Lord Byron.
Well, Lord Byron, how they met was he'd got this unfavourable review from a piece he'd done about America after coming back from America, and he challenged the editor of this review to a duel. But when they both turned up, it turned out that the editor didn't have any balls in the pistol. So he got a lot of abuse at the time first because it was seen that, you know, he'd given a man an empty pistol, which wasn't a good thing. So the as Byron wrote that the courage of the men, just like the pistol balls, had evaporated. So he challenged him to a duel, or certainly implied that he would like to duel him. And
so he challenges Byron to a duel as well?
Well, he implied it. He said, right, he wasn't happy. He wrote a piece. Byron was out of England at the time. And when he came back, they met and they became great friends. And Byron was a massive admirer of his work. When we think of him in a historical context, we think of the Moore's Melodies. But at the time, he would have been extremely highly regarded. Both Byron and Shelley thought he was one of the finest, as did all the critics at the time. And indeed, he had a piece, Lalla Rookh, which in 1817 was the highest price ever paid by a publisher for a work at £3,000. So he was a huge influence at the time.
But, I mean, he was so close to Byron that he was given the responsibility for burning some of Byron's effects, some of his documentary effects, at least.
Yeah, well, it was quite a... Byron gave them to him for safekeeping. We don't know exactly whether he was supposed to burn them, but certainly a lot of pressure came on from the family because there was quite a lot of personal information.
Compromising material
in there. And while it is true that this happened, he did actually come out with this amazing letters and a biography on Lord Byron, which is still the definitive text on it. So he certainly made up if he did do that burning.
But he did burn some of Byron's memoirs.
Yeah, it seems so.
Now, the Irish Melodies, what's the background to the Irish Melodies? Because these come out over a period of basically around about a quarter of a century, don't they?
Yeah, so they came in 10 volumes originally, and he was commissioned to do them. And what he did in terms of the melodies was he put lyrics to them. And he was an amazing lyricist when it came to song and putting lyrics to song.
And these would have been melodies that would have been collected by people like Edward Bunting, that you've mentioned.
Yeah, so indeed Bunting's widow wouldn't have been too happy. You know, Thomas More got a lot of the credit for a lot of what Bunting did because he made them absolutely massively popular.
By putting lyrics to them,
but they were so omnipresent. I mean, it did get him into the upper echelons of English society, which is interesting for a...
Just mention some of the names, some of the songs, some of the melodies that for which he is famous.
Well, the Minstrel Boy was so big in America, that The Last Rose of Summer, Nina Simone has done versions of that. Believe Me If All Those Endearing Young Charms, Bugs Bunny did a fine version of that. it has gone through the whole... As a matter of fact, one of the pieces, Tis Sweet to Think, I was doing some research because we're doing it in the concert, and I found that Bing Crosby had done a version of it. So, I mean, they really are everywhere at that time.
How are you reimagining his work on Friday?
Well, originally, when the work was done, its piano accompaniments were put by Sir John Stevenson, and they were done in the style of the day. They were a parlour song, I suppose. That doesn't work today. The style of today, we're a multicultural society. So while we are staying true to the melodies, we are we're trying to bring the lyrics alive, because his lyrics are really an important part of it. So we've kind of made them into... There are some piano accompaniments and some of the traditional Moore's way of doing it, but we are also making them into jazz songs, world music songs. We have some great traditional players and jazz players along for the evening.
But as you say, the man is very much, he's still relevant. He's not just somebody who preserved melodies. He is still very relevant today.
Unbelievably, the lyrics sail on, and it could be talking about today. 'Tis sweet to think, preempted Crosby, Stills and Nash by half a century. You know, if you can't be with the one you love, love the one you're with.
Love the one you're with. Okay, well, we're going to hear, thank you very much for coming in and for talking to us tonight. And we're going to hear Oft in the Stilly Night, performed by the Moorings. Oft in the Stilly Night, performed there by the Moorings, Simon Morgan on vocals, Drazen Derek on the guitar, and Carl Nesbitt on the bouzouki. And that concert by the Moorings, Thomas Moore Reimagined, is taking place at the Abbey Theatre at 7:30 this Friday, the 1st of February. Tickets available now. We'll put a link on our own website, rte.ie/history. And as I say, that's Simon Morgan earlier talking to us on the History Show about the life of Thomas Moore. After the break, 100 years of women in politics and public life.
Follow us on Twitter at RTE History Show.
Women in Politics and Public Life from 1918 to 2018 is the title of a pop-up museum, which is currently running at Dublin Castle, and it's also touring the country, but in Dublin Castle at the moment. The exhibition shines a spotlight on the stories of very familiar and lesser-known women, exploring the challenges they faced and the considerable obstacles they overcame in the world of politics. I'm joined on the line from Limerick by historian and author Sinead McCool, curator of the exhibition. And with me here in studio is Niamh Brannock, former Labour Party TD and Minister for Education. You're both very welcome to the programme. Sinead, a centrepiece of the exhibition is the one of the original cabinet tables used by the Irish government. Do you have any idea how many cabinet tables there have actually been?
Hello, Miles. Thanks very much for having me. Yes, there are three tables. There's the original one used by the Irish Free State, the one that is in Dublin Castle at the moment, which is the middle table, as it were, which was probably used for the longest period in time. And during the time that Niamh Brannock was at Cabinet, this was the table. There's a photograph where you can clearly see her sitting at this very table. And also, then it was replaced in the last number of years because it became electronic. So it's got the electronics built into the table. So it's a modern table, whereas this is the historic one.
There have been 19 women cabinet ministers in total. The first one was Countess Markovic. There was a hell of a gap to the second one, but it's very interesting. I think it says a lot about political figures. 17 of the 19 are still alive.
Yeah, I think that was that's really important to remember, that this is so, in so many ways, a modern story. So when the opportunity came to look at this for the decade of centenary, so it was done as part of the programme that's been rolled out by Minister Madigan's department. I'm working in the commemorations unit, so this was an idea to celebrate the moment of the vote, but also for the women's strand in general, because it obviously relates to the 100 years of the Doyle. So what was important was to tell the story for students. Some of it's not in the history books yet, so I did a lot of original research, looking at the family stories of the first 21 women, so that would be the women up to 1969 who were serving, when there was obviously no women in cabinet, because obviously that didn't happen until Máire Geoghegan Quinn
It was 60 years, as far as I remember.
Yeah, that's correct. Sorry, I suppose what she was serving in 1969 as a junior minister, with a lovely photograph of the Pope, where she's greeting him with her son. And if you look at it, you'd see it. Think of it as a beautiful looking woman with her child, but obviously she's there in her capacity as a minister in government. So I think what's important in the way that the exhibition is laid out. So it's a pop up women's museum, and the idea is that it tells stories from women's perspective, taking the lead from all the women TDs. So you follow them through the 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s and 60s into the 70s, 80s, 90s and to the 2000s. And how we've laid it out is with clothing, objects, pictures, family album photographs, wedding photographs, memorial cards, so that you actually see them as the human interest story, and so that it also tells you a little bit about them. So, for example, It's not just simply a case of someone being elected because they were a widow, and that is a sympathy vote. You then see how long these women served for. You also see things like the illnesses that they had to cope with, the fact that some of them had an opportunity to get a junior minister post in the case of Joan Burke, who is from Roscommon, and she didn't actually accept that post and had to retire in 1981. She had served from the 1960s. Because of ill health. She'd been in a very bad car accident in the 1970s, and that was the ill health that prevented her from moving onwards.
And not just TDs and ministers, but women in public life, so presumably judges, MEPs, and very obviously a couple of presidents.
Yeah, absolutely. We looked at all the women leaders, and also what I did is, in the context of each of the sections, I based it on the Leaving Cert syllabus, taking the sort of the references from economics or the health or the mother and child scheme or the things that you'd expect, the constitution and all those things, but telling the story as it was from the perspective of women and looking at various different things like religious devotion, looking at things like the best-selling books of the era, which would have been Veritas pamphlets. And so trying to get a flavour for what was influencing people and then how that in turn then reflected on how they voted. And then in the centre of the exhibition, I have the family members talking about what it was like, because obviously at the time in the early years, it was a family business in that people would come to the house. A lot of these women who were elected and continually elected were rural TDs, and the difficulties in managing, and again, we know a lot of them were widows, so they had to manage large families, the farm in some cases, as well as a political life. And it's a really interesting look at a sort of very capable and very able woman. One of the most interesting things about the study, while doing the sort of the underpinning and the research for this, was that I could only come across one woman, and that was Mary Reynolds, who I couldn't trace into secondary school. So obviously in the period before secondary school was freely available to people, the women who actually got secondary school education, who went on, it was very interesting the orders of nuns that educated them and that. And so where the money came for to actually make these women have an opportunity to go on and to have the confidence, I suppose, to enter political life.
Niamh, let's talk about the cabinet table, which is part of one of the centrepieces of this exhibition. Obviously, you sat at that cabinet table. Was it a case when you went into the cabinet room, you kind of, you know, you sort of sat down wherever you felt like, who was first come, first served?
Oh, no, Miles. This was heavily protocoled, I'd say. I was the person at the cabinet table with the least amount of experience. I had been actually appointed a minister on my first day in the Dáil. So that made me automatically the runt of the litter. So I was nearest the door that said exit. And then
did it actually say exit?
No, it didn't actually.
But
there's
yeah.
only one door in and out. So if I would actually have been the first out.
So this was a reminder that you're here on sufferance.
Well,
you're very close to the door and you may not last long.
It's measured up by your seniority would be, have you been in cabinet before? So that's counted, and that actually gets brownie points. And then there's, how long were you in the Dáil? Did you serve in the Senate? So because Michael D had served in the Senate, he was up the pecking order to me, who had served nowhere. So that was how it was judged.
So if you were Minister for Finance, which would be, you know, the second most important position in the land, as it were, and, you know, OK, we'll accept Tánaiste. But if it was your first day in the Dáil, you could end up sitting in the same seat that you were sitting in.
Oh, I'm sure protocol would be flexible.
Right.
And would move me up the table. But nobody was being particularly flexible at my time. It was the first time in the history of the state that two women had got in to sit at the cabinet table.
Morna Gagan Quinn was
so
at the table as well.
Quinn, who I actually couldn't see. It's an oval table. And my position on my way out the door, actually she was on the same side but further up. So for most of the meetings, I could hear her but I couldn't have see her. So it was very structured, and how this exhibition is laid out, for each of those places at the cabinet table there are monitors. So there is a monitor full of my memorabilia that Sinead collected. So you can actually go and sit down and press the button and see what actually is the Maura Gagan Quinn story, what is the Niamh Brannock story.
And in terms of the memorabilia, because the exhibition is all about material culture, what kind of things did you contribute to it? What kind of things did you hang on to, and have you now handed over to Sinead?
Well, you see, that really begs the next question. Where is everything going to go when the pop-up pops down? One of the things in the exhibition is a poster from Mary Robinson's campaign, which came from my son, MacDara, and it was under his bed. And that, I mean, the memory, there are photographs of my mother and father. There's me as a child in the 50s. There's a lot of the early election literature. But all the time, you're quite aware that a lot of this stuff is actually under people's beds. And I'm hoping, because Sinead has a great record at putting all this stuff together, that actually when it's finished travelling, and I know she's hoping to get a snapshot of the exhibition to different points in Ireland, that maybe Minister Madigan might pick up on something that Monica Barnes was very exercised about in her day, a women's museum. And Monica Barnes worked with Maeve Ruan and with Mary Jones. And I actually sat on that committee where we hoped for an archive and we hoped for a museum. And now that it has got as far as Coach House in Dublin Castle, it's under the auspices of the Department of Art, Culture and the Gaeltacht. Certainly, we seem to have a minister who's particularly interested in the theme of this, that if at the end for Sinead and for all of us who contributed, and we were delighted to do so, but that there actually will be somewhere permanent, that when we do pass on and whatever is found under our beds can actually go off to be judged somewhere else.
I mean, if you're finding stuff under your son's beds, there's obviously a lot more, a lot more to be found. But Sinead, I mean, I was astonished to realise that it took almost a century until we saw 100 women TDs elected. That's not all in one Dáil, that's over a period of 100 years.
Yeah, that was in 2016 that it hit 100, and now it's 114.
So not even a full Dáil still.
Yes, it isn't. I think the importance, though, around this exhibition, just to pick up what Niamh Branagh is saying, is to try and write that story as sort of, in a way, driven by that material culture, to make the point that this is a women's museum about the leading women of the country, the women who had, you know, the top offices. So whether it's collected digitally in a way, or if it's collected through the objects, what's really interesting about the way that it's laid out, and this is the same experience for women's museums all over the world. I think there's 88 of them now, and there's also like another 44 initiatives. And what people have been trying to do across the world is to try and come against what is the traditional museum, which is obviously patriarchal and would have been set up, you know, for the successes of men. And then it's in difficulty of setting up something like this is it seems like as if you're criticizing what's happening in the museums in your region or your country and or even globally. But what's important is the collection. So if people don't know that something has a value, so at least for the even the sitting politicians now, they can look at the types of materials. So whether or not it's a piece of literature from Countess Markovitch, or the bag that she used while she was on the run during the War of Independence, or a dress which was an Irish Ireland dress that was kept because it belonged to Kate O'Callaghan. I mean, that's just in the 20s. But as you go through the exhibition, you know, it changes and morphs over time. So as you make your way through the exhibition and pass the outfit, let's say, that Eileen Desmond wore when she was Minister of Health and Social Welfare in the 1980s, 1981. Again, it evokes the 1980s period. And then as you walk through, you know, you're trying to get a sense of people and things, but also what they did. And not to trivialise what they did by putting it through the objects in any way.
We have to leave it. We've got to get out. But thank you very, very much indeed for talking to us, Sinead McCool, and also Niamh Branagh of the Pop-Up Museum, Women in Politics and Public Life. He's running at the Coach House Gallery in Dublin Castle Gardens in Dame Street until next Sunday, the 3rd of February, and thereafter we'll be going on tour around the country. That's all we've got on this evening's programme. Thanks to Mark McGrath Sound and our researcher Liz Gillis. The History Show is a Pegasus production for RTE. For me, Miles Dungan, the producer, Logan Clancy. Goodbye, and thanks for listening.